Well, my name's Bill Hewitt, and I come from Valdosta State University. And so what I think what I'm going to do is fits into this theme of the conference. So just take a look at this a second. And what do you think you see there? Actually, this is the percent of the economy that people are actually getting wages from. So it's not so much what's actually being bought and sold, but how are people earning money as they participate in the economy. So if you were just going to tell somebody what you saw out of that, what would be something that you would say was important out of that graph?
Best chance of getting a job is going to be if you're able to engage in the information sector.
So all of us, if you just look at this and we say this is 1990 and this is a little over 100-year period, that where the shift has been is away from making stuff and growing stuff to thinking about stuff and doing the service economy, which is fixing cars and cutting hair and cutting grass and all that kind of thing. So we have a totally different context within which we're going to be engaging economically in our adult lives. And when were our schools developed? does that make sense? And so essentially what's happened is that the world has changed, and we're trying to think about how we need to change in terms of schooling. So the whole idea of what does it mean to be an educated citizen? And I use that term rather than educated person, because in my view, we need to think of individual embedded in some sort of society. And it's not just the learner is center, or the student is center, or the school is center. It's all central, depending upon what your question is and what you're looking at, what you're trying to do. But the 20th century economy, we just look at this. It transformed from the point where my father was migrant labor, picking crop, and my mother comes out of coal mining. So, getting the raw materials and migrant labor to the point where I'm making a living, and my children make livings. I got three adult children, and we're all in the information sector. So how did it go from the point where he was riding a mule back and forth to school to the point where I don't think anything about getting on a plane and going to Czechoslovakia or South America or whatever, or you don't think anything of coming here for, that's a totally different world that was not open. So the major issue of the industrial age is standardization of outcomes and processes and this effectiveness and efficiency, and we're still caught up in that. So how do we say we're doing a good job? Well, we have this outcome. Our students have this achievement scores, or we send this number of students off to university, or some other relatively standardized form of judging effectiveness. And then how efficient are we? So how much did it cost you to get that? What was your cost per unit of student achievement? And so we're all focused on this idea of, can we define what it means to be successful in terms of outcomes, and have we properly used our resources? So throughout this, especially in the early part of the century, we focused on leadership. As we were generating new ideas about schools, the whole entrepreneurial ethic of I have a new idea, I'm going to try it out, gave way to management, which is making sure that I have accounted for the desks, the students, the pencils, the paper, and so somebody else has given me a vision, somebody else has given me an idea about what I'm supposed to do, and now I need just to manage that whole process. Well, all of this is exemplified, at least in the U.S., it's very similar in the U.K., but the Carnegie units and what it means to these number of units has to be done and these numbers of courses to graduate from this level, and then the whole standardized testing. I know what needs to be done. I know how to judge it, and it's your... I set the bar, you jump. And everybody's supposed to be meeting these same standards. So leadership gave way to management. Now, this is just high school figures for the U.S., but 10% in 1990 to 75% in 1975. I don't think there's any argument that if we look at the effectiveness of what we were trying to achieve, which is an educated workforce to go into the manufacturing sector of the economy, that we did a decent job. I mean, you know, 10% to 75%. Well, this was accompanied by substantial increases in productivity. And here's the issues that I want to get to, which is all of a sudden, technology is coming at a speed. Technology has always been important. From the plow behind the mule to the tractor to the big combines, it's always been important. But it's computers and the internet. Over the past decade, two decades, that have absolutely revolutionized what we're doing today, and any conceptualization of the future has to do that. That somebody else reported, I don't know if it was in just our small group, I can't remember, but the Kurzweil's idea that by the year 2020, we will have a computer that has a computational power of a human brain, and by 2025, it costs $2,000 and sits on your desktop. And if you see over here in this network, and you can imagine each one of these hooked up into a network where you give the network a problem to solve, and you have a supercomputer through that network that is far removed from anything we can even begin to conceptualize now. So that's the process that we're living in. That's the realm that we're living in. Everybody's recognizing this, that we're in a global economy. We're just talking about whether that is a good thing or bad thing. Well, we can have all kinds of discussions about that, but we're in the middle of it. You know, customized economy is another thing, which is we kind of expect that we're going to be able to have things fit us, and so we're not looking to see that everything is standardized, but it's customized. And decentralization in terms of decision making, which simply means that where the decision is going to be implemented, the decisions are made. And so the idea of a top-down hierarchy where the federal government, the state government, or some agency sets all the rules for everybody, and then everybody kind of follows along, the economy is moving away from that. Business is moving away from that. The speed of change is phenomenal. At least in the U.S., 1930 is something like 30 million farmers producing enough to feed 150 million people. In 10 years, or actually about 30 years later, we've got 3 million farmers feeding 200 million people and putting out enough food to feed another 100 million. So that's the technology, that's the whole idea of global economy. We wouldn't be growing that much if we weren't living in a growing a global economy that allowed us to sell our goods and services. So the whole decreased importance of manufacturing and the increased importance of distribution, at least as we saw in that you know, when you got 3% of your workforce in farming and 10% of your workforce in manufacturing, begin to get the picture of exactly what that means. So these are just the backdrop, I think, of what we've been talking about so far in this conference. So let me just point out some things that, that a couple of these that I think are important for schooling. One is decentralization. And for schooling, that means that, that standards and curricula and methods of evaluation are made at the site level. And this is a major movement from a centralized. How to get this done, we're just now beginning to look at it. We do have multiple standards. We in the States, at least, we have minimum competency standards. We have national grade level standards. And then we have global excellence standards. And we kind of put people by schools. And so at some schools, we just hope they meet the minimum. Some parents are not going to be acceptance of that, and they're going to have their children, they're going to move their family to be in a different situation that will then demand national or global standards. The curricula is kind of going along with that. We're coming up with multiple different types of curricula. The problem, as I see it, is we're using a single evaluation standard, a source. And so we look at test scores. Are your students doing a good job? Test scores are up. And if you have come in with a different idea about what students should be learning, they're still judged on the same standard. So that we have to adopt and prepare or develop our own, which means that we don't have to do it all ourselves. We could look out there and see what else is there and say, I like what you're doing, I want to adopt yours. But nobody's mandating that I have to do exactly what everybody else is doing. And here's another point that I think is absolutely critical to this, is that it is then up to the decision makers at the school level to demonstrate that they have added value. That if we do away with a standardized value-added system, when you say you want to do something, this is what you want to accomplish, it's up to you to demonstrate that you've done that. This is a huge, huge task. And I'm not sure that we're really prepared for doing that. But in terms of, and then finally, the state or the federal government or the country level, whatever that is, they are auditing performance much like we have in other industries, where is the federal regulations is not saying this is how to do it, but we were going to come in and look at what you're supposed to be doing and say whether or not it meets the standard. So a customized economy, which means that the consumers produce a selected product or service, in my mind then, who's the consumer? Now, is the student the consumer? Are the parents the consumers? Is society, at least for public school, public education, it's tax money that's going in to provide this school service, are they the consumers? I think that how you answer that question begins to impact the kinds of decisions you might make. So if these discussions focus solely on the student as the consumer, the student is the focus, I think we take the person, the child, out of the context of family and society and say, well, they don't have any voice. Now, I'm not sure that that's going to get us where we want to go. Now, this is then, if you're going to have a customized economy, you've got to have reliable and valid data. If you can't depend on the data, if those data don't mean what it is that they say they mean, then the idea that you can make good decisions and customize a service or product for yourself, it's not going to happen. In other words, I can't get a customized shirt unless we have a standard measurement of inches or whatever, centimeters, that would say, this is the length. Because I say, well, make it about that long. I'm probably not going to get a shirt that's going to fit me. Yeah. So, and finally, at least the last one I'm just going to talk about is the rapid rate of change, which means that we have to constantly and continually look at both our goals and our activities. That whatever we do now is not going to stay the same for the rest of our working lives. That there's a time frame that we need to plan for, and then we need to plan for the next change. That we could simultaneously maintain and renegotiate the values and principles. And what I really mean by that is that what we value right now with additional learning may change, the principles may change, and we've got to constantly renegotiate what's important, because that's going to impact what we do. And if we never renegotiate what we think is important, then it's very difficult to have different ideas about what to do, or make those work, at least. So just as an example of that, this is called the S-curve, and I don't know if you've ever seen something like this before. It's a very common graph that's used in business, but the idea here is that there's a trend line that says there's a first 10% of any innovation happens in some period of time. You take that same period of time and you get 90%. And then you take that same period of time to go from 90 to 100, from almost to ubiquitous. And so now, if we begin to look at that concept of the S-curve, we just think in terms of how many of you have a cell phone, right? How many of you had a cell phone 10 years ago? Did we see it? In some period of time, we went from 10% to 90%, practically 100%. And do you have a cell phone? Yeah. Do you have a landline coming into your house, or do you just use your cell phone as your...
Oh yeah, my cell phone's
the only thing. You see, he's younger than we are. So no, some of us who are older, we still have, because we hold on to it. You know, we need to call our mother, or whatever. I mean, I don't have long distance on my landline. I use long distance. I use my cell phone. Why do I have a? I don't know why I have one, but you know, I've always had. And you would think, get rid of it. Well, that's just happened. Now, how many of you use high speed access on your? So when did you use it 5 years ago? No. When will everybody use it? 2009. This is what took generations and generations to make changes. We're taking phenomenal changes, and we don't even get to make those changes before the next change is coming. And so we're operating in 5 and 10 year. And you go 10 years beyond where we are right now and try to predict what's going on. You can't do it. You can barely predict 5, and if you get next 6 months, you've done a good job. So now, these are things that are impacting our ability to handle these changes in schooling and education. So here's my major message. As a result of these changes from the agricultural, industrial to the information age, as a result of this decentralization, customized economy, and speed of change, that we're moving to school choice as the way we make decisions about where to go to school. The whole idea of neighborhood public school, that you go to the school as assigned by the district because you live on this side of the street and not the other side of the street, that's going away. And we would just not put up with the idea that I drive a black Ford and you live next to me, therefore you have to drive a black Ford too. That concept is just, we wouldn't put up with it. And yet we will put up with that when it comes to the preparation of our children for successful adulthood. So Here's at least in the U.S. Britain, the numbers are pretty close. Holland, the numbers are off the scale on this. So we have this wide range, but 25% of K-12 students not attending a neighborhood public school. Now, if you just look at that from what it took to get 10% to go for 25%, this is a relatively new phenomenon. The last 25 or 30 years, about the time that we got 75% students graduating from high school, we began to make this shift into away from neighborhood public school. So, decreased by 7.5% in just a 10-year period of time. Now, if you looked at that other scale, what you saw was it is not a constant. It's not a linear. It speeds up. So we can make the prediction that based on where we are right now, the next 10 years is not going to be another 7.5%. It's going to be 15, 20, 30, 40, something along those lines. So the school choice is upon us, and we need to think through exactly what that means. So, in the U.S., we've had a big discussion. I don't think vouchers really caught on that much in Britain, but other countries have used this concept. Sweden used it for a while. But the whole idea of I will give you a blank check, and you're going to spend it whatever educational institution you want to spend it on, that kind of came and went. So if you're looking for a trend, that trend just didn't make it. If you look at private schools, at least in the U.S., and I was trying to keep the picture kind of clean, so I wasn't trying to do it for everybody, but U.S., 29,000 some odd schools and 5.3 million students, which is something on the order of about 8 to 10% of the student body. That dramatically changed in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, but hasn't really changed that much, beginning to decline. Homeschooling, about 1.1 million students, and that's up from about 700,000 5 years previous to that. In 1998, it's about 700,000. So that's still a growing trend. Might be some limits to that because we just run out of homes where there's somebody home. So I don't think this is going to be 90% of our population being homeschooled. I just don't see it. About 13% of them together. But the real shift has been in magnet schools, which in 2001 was about 1.4 million, 1,700 schools. Which I thought was interesting was that's a decline. So if we're talking about the increase of school choice, that... Can I just have one more? Yeah, right. A magnet school is a public school governed by the school board that has a particular theme, like agriculture or tourism or whatever. So they will... Savannah has a lot of magnet schools just south of here. They do a lot with that. Other school districts may not do it, but it's the idea of the school board has control of this, but it's a school choice. And we did it in the States a lot for integration purposes. And so we had the idea of if we build this really, really good school, then people of different races will go to school together. We will choose to go there. So it seems like it's that whole concept is still there, still thriving. But what they have done is developed very well how to go about implementing and evaluating these different themes from business and finance, ecology. There's a magnet school in Savannah that is going to do oceanography. So how do you incorporate all of your academics and everything else around your school around a common theme, bringing in people who are interested in that area? So they have done a good job with this, and so we can learn an awful lot from them about how we can put a different idea into practice. Now, that what I found was interesting, that 11 of the 100 largest school districts have more than 20% of their students attending magnet schools. So in the United States, at least, if you want to kind of go know what's going on in education, look at the urban schools, look at the larger schools. So they're still doing a lot with magnet schools. 3%, 3 of the 100 largest have more than 40%. In other words, they have made a major initiative to implement magnet schools into their school districts. And again, how are they doing that? How are they managing that? How are they making choices? How do they allocate resources? There's a lot to be learned from the folks who've been doing this now for a decade. This is not a brand new aspect here. So the one that's come in last is charter schools. And basically, charter school has the same kind of a theme as a magnet school, but it's owned and operated privately. And so it's not run and governed by the school board, it's run and governed by a charter. And more often than not, the charter is drawn up by people who are parents or an entrepreneur will have an idea and go out and solicit. Wouldn't you like your child to be in this school? Here, sign this petition. And so they go around and develop a school. But it's really much more of an entrepreneurial effort outside of the public school governance structure than we see. But almost 3,000 of these schools in 2004, but only 700,000 students. Now, you get the picture that these charter schools are a little bit smaller, a little bit more focused. The variety is even wider than the magnet schools. 37 states have implemented out of 50, which means that not everybody's kind of getting onto this, but here's the number that I saw. 28% increase from 1997. Now, the first charter school was in 1991. And this has just taken off like wildfire. Where is this going? Well, you can say, well, it's going to go like homeschooling and grow for a little bit more. It's going to go like magnet schools, which has hit a peak and drop. I'm saying that this whole concept of school choice is going to be with us, and this is going to be one alternative, one piece. The other thing I found that was interesting is 73% of all the charter school enrollment is in 10 states. This is not evenly distributed. Arizona, California, Colorado, Florida. Basically, if you look at this, it's Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, in the Midwest, Wisconsin, North Carolina and Florida in the Southeast, and Texas, Colorado in the West, and then California in Arizona in the far West. In other words, we have pockets of these states that we're now beginning to permeate. We haven't really developed a strong law here in Georgia, but we're on the verge of doing in Georgia what happened in Florida, South Carolina. Does this make sense to you? Because it started in a spot, now it's beginning to grow out. My expectations are that charter schools, as well as the next option, are really going to grow. And the next option, magnet and charter schools, 4% of total enrollment. But the other option coming is open enrollment, which is that you can attend any school in your county, in a cross-county area in the state. Some states have, if you are live in the state, you can attend any school in the state. Doesn't make any difference. And the only reason that they can't accept you is because they run out of chairs. but if you want to go there, then you just send your school there, your student there. Now, it's a couple places in Georgia. One is in Gainesville, Georgia, which is just a little bit north of Atlanta. It's a relatively smaller districts, not really big, but they have implemented this. And so one high school, but they have a couple of different programs within the high school, a couple of middle schools, several elementary schools. Each of these has a different theme, a different orientation, different mission. And as long as you're living in that whole area, you can send your child any place you want to go. Talk to some people and some others on some school boards. They think that this is going to be the first step. that they, instead of say, the school board developing a magnet school, they would go to the school and say, what is your theme? And then have the school develop that. So with these combinations, I think the open enrollment in charter schools really going to grow, which leads me to the second piece.